Welcome back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. So, what does that mean? We started off talking about how the U.S. Census Bureau is saying that the demographics of America, they're changing. Three things to take in mind and keep into account. One is that America is becoming blacker and browner and more Asian than ever before. Those are the groups that are increasing. This population group of about 23 million people who now racially self-identify as black, Hispanic, Asian, or as biracial. Whites, those who self-identify only as white, that population is growing. It's shrinking fast. For the first time in the history of this experiment called democracy, whites will be in the minority. And we need to take a look at what that means. Not that we're saying it needs to stop happening. No, I think we need to kind of shake some things up. We got to talk about how the overall growth of America has slowed down in the last 10 years, we've only grown by 7%, which is really, really low. Second is that Americans are getting older than ever before. We're having fewer kids. And as such, we have fewer young people going into the job market, into the housing market, into the electorate. That's not happening. Folks have fewer kids and they're living longer, which means they're holding off on retirement. They're sucking up the Social Security, living their best lives, green tea, juicing. They're taking yoga, eating shawarma, the whole thing. And as a result, they're living much longer than what was originally set up when we put the Social Security system in place. People didn't expect folks to live to 100 years plus, but they are. Third, and I think this is why we have to be concerned, is that because we are growing so slow as a nation, that what does that then portend for how we go forward? That's what the U.S. Census Bureau put out when they gave an overall view of America from the 2020 census. I want to note the census also showed that Baltimore population numbers are dropping, but Maryland's population numbers are growing. So Maryland is getting bigger. Baltimore City, in terms of our population, is getting smaller. That was not something I wanted to hear. I had hoped that Baltimore City, that our population numbers were going up. It's not that people are moving out of Maryland. They are not. They're moving out of Baltimore. And I don't know how we go forward or what we do about it, but it is the state of where we are at this moment. And it should kind of give us pause to think. 410-319-8888 if you want to get in on the conversation. Because I want to talk about, as we continue to talk about how America is becoming more black and brown and Asian than ever before, I have two topics I want to put on the table for this hour. The first one that might get you going. It came out from the GRIO. It's called Black Love or War: How Racism Hinders Black Dating and Relationships. How we, right now, are talking about how we can figure out how racism is keeping us, as black folks, from loving one another, from having healthy relationships. Many heterosexual black men and women find themselves in a fight to find the one. Now, if you are someone and you are in a same-sex relationship and you are saying, no, 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 it's not just straight folk who are having a hard time finding the one. It's also everybody, all of us, are having a hard time finding the one with quotations, the one to plant roots with, to build our lives with, the one to grow old with. We're having a hard time trying to find the one. Now, there are some self-help books and online relationship experts who have us believing that self-development is the only cure for the distance between black men and women seeking companionship. We are unable to find the one because we are not spending enough time on self-development, on self-care. They're saying, look, sister, look, brother, if you want to find the one, of an opposite gender, then you need to do some self-development. There's a new argument on the table that says, look, it is much deeper than that. In the book, Black Women, Black Love, America's War on African-American Marriage by Diane Stewart from Emory University, she says slavery and racism have historically prevented and disrupted Black marital unions, and it continues to plague the Black community and Black relationships today. We can't find love because of the history of slavery. We can't find love because of the history of racism. We can't even find the one because we live in a system in which we are oppressed because of the color of our skin. I think we got to go back a little bit, right? So I took a look at Diane Stewart's work to think about whether or not, you know, it's true. Is there any truth to this idea that even today, in 2021, Black folks have a difficult time with relationships because of slavery from 1619? That today, in 2021, Black folks have a difficult time finding the one because of Jim Crow in 1952? Today, Black folks have a hard time finding someone to plant roots with, to build with, to grow with, because slavery and Jim Crow have destroyed our understanding of the family. That we no longer have this belief. I'm thinking Diane Stewart's book. Part of me, to be honest, part of me is saying, okay, there could be some truth to this. And the truth has to be rallied around the understanding of this slave experience of Black folks in this country. Let me just say, because I don't want to let the system off the hook, that if we are saying that Black folks have a difficult time finding the one, or being the one, or being in love, or accepting love, or giving love, because we were enslaved and oppressed, then we have to stop and take a look at the one who enslaved us and who oppressed us. That we've got to say we are here today because the system that was in place stopped us from moving forward. Like we were kept from planting deep family roots. We know it was illegal for Black folks to get married. I think it is huge that we come from a legacy where it was illegal for Black folks to marry. They did not want us to get married. Now, we can span that out a little bit because it was illegal for us to read. It was illegal for us to write. It was illegal for us to move without having our papers on us. Like, but this notion that marriage was something that was huge. Now, I'm not talking about Loving v. Virginia. That case was struck down in 1967. I'm saying what I'm looking at is how Black folks were not allowed to get married. And when we did establish these roots within the Black community on the plantation, we knew the roots were very loose in a lot of ways, because at any moment, on any day, particularly on the first day of the year, your, quote, husband that you've jumped the broom with, your, quote, wife that you've jumped the broom with, could be taken from you and sold off at a moment's notice without your permission, without your involvement. You had no rights that the plantation owner was bound to respect because you were property. So if we're going to say that today Black folks can't love each other, we got to talk about a system that denied us for years, hundreds of years, the freedom to love one another. I want to say one more thing before I go to Curtis. Let's also remember in having this discussion that when slavery ended with the ratification of the 13th Amendment, back in 1865, there were hundreds of black folks, men and women, who set off on foot, said, I'm leaving this plantation because I'm going to look for my wife, look for my husband, look for my children. Because even though you deny the legality of my marriage, I know I jumped the broom with Kissy, and she's my wife, and I'm going to get my wife. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Curtis first, and then we'll go to Ladarius. Curtis from Baltimore, how are you?
I am great, Dr. K. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for calling.
So your last part of your comment that you just made just proved what I called in to say, that I can't see that opinion being factual at all about black folks don't know how to love.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even grasp that, Dr. K, because I feel like if it wasn't for the love that we as a people had in our hearts, we would have been turned this world upside down, right? But speaking on male and female, Dr. K, you said it at the end of your comment just now, how after the slavery ended, men and women set out on their bare feet from the plantation to find the ones that they love. So I can't get that book, Dr. K.
I'm telling you.
I can't get it because the fact is that I know in my family, marriage runs deep between man and woman in my family. And I have a really, really big family. And most of us in our family has found someone to love for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
Sometimes two or three times. But I'm just saying, Dr. K.
Let's be real.
I don't feel that book, Dr.
No,
K.
Neither do I. I'm sitting there saying, wait a minute. We don't know how to love. Now, you're talking to someone. I've been married for 22 years, and I am the daughter of my parents who've been married for, 55 years? Who are the sons and daughters of my grandparents who were married until death to them part. They got married like 16 mm-hmm. years old.
See? That's what I'm saying.
Marriage runs
Kay.
Deep in my family, deep. So I don't know what this means if we can't do this, because I think we are doing it.
Yes, we are.
Yes,
and
we
been
are.
Doing.
Been doing it. I like what you said. Sometimes two or three times.
Exactly.
I like that. Thank you, Curtis. I appreciate you calling.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye. Let's go to Ladarius. Ladarius is driving on I-95. How are you, Ladarius?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good.
Thanks for calling in.
I'm not going to really respond to too much because I ain't gonna lie, I'm on the road. But all I want to say is I'm 28, and I do feel like it's about the personal choices that you make in life.
Mm.
I think a lot of people now are just running away from trauma that they had, and that's what's causing them to not be themselves.
Mm.
And that's why you can't find love, because you don't have a line of what's right and what's wrong. That's why I don't even really listen to too much rap music no more, because they're telling me nothing good. Most of these guys talk about this and that, and they have a loving wife at home that's taking care of their kids.
Yeah. That's actually a good point.
It's just about the message that I'm not saying all music is bad. I'm not saying all music is bad. It's just about choosing. Some people choose to get lost in it, and that's what's going on. I'm not saying it's just music.
Right.
It's just we're in an age of information, and everybody wants to be validated through social media. Everybody wants to feel some type of whatever it is they're running from. But I know a lot of people that's going through so many things and don't even know that they're depressed. You know what
right.
I'm saying? Like, that are going through, that are really struggling and, you know, don't really even know what's going on next. But they know that they're going to, you know, smoke. They know what they're going to do. And it's just like, you just have to choose your vices. And don't let nothing take over. You know, I know people that's a pastor, and they don't love their people because they're a lesbian or they're this or they're that. And it's like, when do we stop focusing on one situation
right.
and say, it's so many other things that's wrong in this world? And when do we not get over that type of hump with our own, you know, with our own people?
Well, let me ask you one question, Ladarius. I know you're driving. 28 years old. Have you found love?
I have, and that's why I'm speaking out, because I was one that you know, felt like my saboteur in my head used to tell me all the time, you know, that's dead. A woman everybody cheats. I had that thought at one point. But I had to look, and if I think everybody cheats, then what makes me better than the next man who's going to teach? You know what I mean?
Right,
I can't, because I'm not going to teach, so I can't sit there and put that on the next woman who, and I don't know what she's been through. I don't, you know what I mean? I can't, but it's all about what you really believe. And I know that there's somebody out here for everybody, even if it's not, you know, the opposite sex, even if it is the same sex. What are you, like, why are you beating that person down? I don't understand. They already probably need love more than anything because, you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. Thank you so much, LaDarius. I appreciate you. One of the things, yes, absolutely. One of the things that LaDarius and Curtis both tapped into, and folks, there's a line open for you, 410-319-8888. The capture of black folks during the transatlantic slave trade, and just so that we're all clear, the transatlantic slave trade talks about Europeans coming down from Europe, going onto the continent of Africa, primarily the west coast of Africa, and they were trading trinkets for human capital and taking that human capital and bringing it into the Americas, not just North America, but also South America, that if you look at it on a big map or a globe, it makes up almost like a triangle shape, right? So the transatlantic, what they call the triangle trade system. So with the capture of African folks during the transatlantic slave trade, you know who they focused on. Let me just be clear. They focused on men and women in their prime years for marriage and companionship. That's what they did. They were not snatching up a bunch of people that were older, right? Because you got to be able to be young enough to make the journey. They want young folks that they just assume were strong enough to make the journey in the hull of a ship. They weren't taking children. Why? Children were rarely ever out by themselves. Like, they were snatching up people. It wasn't like they walked into a village and just started taking them. No, they were snatching folks up. Because of that, because they took and captured Africans in the prime years for marriage and companionship, they put them in situations where they kept them unstable. There was never a feeling of closure. There was never a feeling of coming together, that your life did not belong to you. It belonged to the plantation owner. So you fall in love with Henry, he may be gone tomorrow. It says, black folks, we had to adapt to a new an extremely traumatic normal, and we have continued to act out of that space. 410-319-8888. Melanie's on the phone. Melanie's a new caller. Hey, Melanie, how are you?
Hey, Dr. K, what's going on?
What's going on? Thanks for calling.
Yeah, no problem. I'm happy I actually got through.
Yeah, I'm glad you did.
Yeah, so I wanted to speak on the topic that you're talking about black people and the ability to love based on years of slavery. It was so refreshing to hear that you were talking about this on the radio, because I've actually had this conversation with my fiance multiple times. Just to be quick, you know, as a person who grew up single parent household, I had my dad was a part of the crack epidemic when it hit and all that stuff, and, you know, wasn't around. So for me, I grew up without having that example of what that black strong family actually looked like. So I took that with me as I started dating and thinking that, like, you know, men are always going to run away. They're always going to do this, do that. It's always going to be the woman. But then once I went to school and I started educating myself and learning more about slavery and the lasting ramifications of it, when you break a family down in the way that slavery did, like, you could marry somebody, you could have kids with somebody, and knowing that that person could be ripped away from you at any moment, how do you fully, like, lay into that and, like, really own that? You know, that family and that relationship and that love. I'm fortunate to have found love. You know, the person that I love now, I was able to lay that with him and just share with him the concern that I had about how slavery has impacted us and has had lasting impact. But I don't know. I just wanted to say my two cents on how I think there's validity to how slavery really broke the family and how that is still so present nowadays.
But then the question I want to ask you, Melanie, before you go. So because slavery, and I agree with you, it broke us in so many ways. Do you think that black love is at the heart of us getting healing? I mean, do our men, I'm just going to say our, right? Do our black men know how to love? Do our sisters know how to love? because we've been taught to hate ourselves.
Right. So do we know how to love? Absolutely. And I may be biased in my opinion, but we are the most loving people on this planet. And had we not been, like the caller before said, we would have turned things upside down a long time ago. I think what's happening is that mainstream media and pop culture is driving whether or not we will lean into that love. I'm only 31. I consider myself relatively young, but a lot of people in my generation are taking the easy route of, you know, oh, these, you know, what's for everybody, everybody cheese, you know, we like the idea of love, but we're not willing to do the hard work of actually sitting in it, being uncomfortable, being vulnerable, putting your trust and your faith into somebody. Right. It's just a lot easier to lean into what seems cool.
Yeah, I like that you're saying it. Thank you so much, Melanie, for just chiming in. So, folks, when we start talking about love and relationships and whether or not our people are able to love, because this book is saying, look, we don't know how to love. Why? Because we come from a legacy of slavery. And because of that legacy, we no longer know how to love one another. We no longer know how to do that. That we are caught up at this moment in trying to get through what became a new and extremely traumatic normal. That's what we were dealing with, this normal where all of a sudden we were led to believe that we don't know how to have relationships. We don't know how to love one another. We don't know how to be together at all. Because of that, what we're looking at is a legacy and a history of not being able to be together. She goes on in this book, this is Diane Stewart's book, she goes on to say that because of the incessant sexual violation and exploitation, it tested our anatomical, our emotional, our psychological, and our spiritual limits because of the heinous violations on our bodies and on our psyche, whether it's the rape or the beatings or even worse, the emotional trauma of loving someone and having them pulled away from you, of having your relationship not recognized, or loving someone who was seen as a breeder. Like, we got to talk about that too, because we understand that human capital, black bodies, meant more money in either the selling of that body or in the exploitation of that body, human capital. And as a woman or as a man, if you were at that age, your prime years, then you were going to be bred. It sounds horrible, but it is absolutely the truth. It should not be anything that is a surprise. Because we've talked about this. We know that slavery is built upon human capital. It's built upon our labor. It's built upon exploiting our bodies, exploiting our minds, exploiting our emotions. And if we're trying to figure out why we can't go be together, according to Diane Stewart, it's because of our shame, our embarrassment, our exposure, our lack of control over our body. All of these rituals, these rites of passage, have kept us from being able to love one another. African-American love, coming through slavery, right? Because she argues that African-American love was defined and even devised during slavery. It presented an escape hatch for us. That the only escape hatch was Christian heterosexual marriage as a gateway to responsible citizenship. Oh, this is going in a different direction. When we come back, I'm going to finish Diane Stewart's piece, and then I want to talk about the different types of Karens and keep the phone lines open for you when we return. To today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. KY's Whitehead. Zora on Facebook Live says, look, the history of enslaved Africans did not start with slavery. I absolutely agree with you, and in no way was I saying this. I'm just talking about Diane Stewart and the work that's being done in this book. You know that there were social structures in the African community on the continent? Absolutely. And part of what American slavery did, and really it was the capture of enslaved Africans is the whole idea was that it began to tear down the structures that were in the African communities. And we understand all of this is connected. And there's no way that we can go forward unless we truly understand the long-term impact of this on our communities and why it is that we have to understand where we're going. To wrap up this piece, which I think is fascinating, because it goes in to talk about the policies on our community. The last piece I want to note, and this comes from a 2009 study by Derek Hamilton, Arthur Goldsmith, and William Darity Jr., where they looked at a large database of Black women and girls. And do note, this is connected to this belief that was pushed in our community. This part here is what got me going. Talking about light skin versus dark skin. I know. Can you believe we're still having that discussion? A discussion that happened during American slavery is a discussion that's happening today. This is this historic colorism that's been perpetuated in the media. These battles, light skin versus dark skin. Song lyrics, music videos, movies, I mean, aspects of our culture deal with this ongoing perpetuation that there is tension between Black folks who are light skin and Black folks who are dark skin. You know what I'm talking about. This study, where they looked at a large database of Black women and girls, found that among 16 to 29-year-olds, light-complexion Black women were twice as likely to marry than dark-complexion Black women, and 17% more likely to marry than women of median skin. I'm telling you. I mean, this is just insane to me. I mean, it's really, like, when you start talking about who gets married, that light-skinned folks get married more than dark-skinned folks, specifically talking about women, I don't know. This study that they did goes back. This study goes back to 2009. Y'all, so much has happened since 2009, particularly around the ways in which we have intentionally worked to lift up women of all different skin colors. I don't know if we're still having the same light skin, dark skin debate. Really? You think so? 410-319-8888. Christian's on the phone from Severn. Christian, how are you? Christian, are you with us? How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. I just wanted to comment really quickly on the British Crown and their role in slavery.
Yes.
I watched the documentary series Explained by Vox on Netflix. And they explained how the British Crown actually was the largest importer-exporter of slaves across the entire time of slavery, and they're responsible for, I want to say, like, 75% of all slave trade that came through the United States and the Caribbean. And if they were to pay what they owe to African descendants of slaves, that it would be I think it's somewhere in the trillions of dollars.
I'm glad you said that. But let me ask you this, Christian, before I go to Dr. Joella. Do you think that when we start talking about reparations, that we should also look to either sue or hold the British Crown responsible reparations in place?
I don't think it's a problem of the British government. I think it's specifically the British Crown, because they're the ones who profited the most from it.
Right.
You know, at the time of slavery, there was no British government. It was the British Crown who was profiting from it. They were taking money from their serfs, their territories. They're the ones who were getting all the benefits from slavery. They don't pay anything in taxes. Most of their money comes from government funds, and they're one of the most independently wealthy families for no other reason other than God deemed it so.
I'm so glad you put that on the table. Thank you so much, Christian. And yep. I want to go to Dr. Joella. Dr. Joella, how are you?
Fine, thank you, Dr. K. This is Dr. Joella Abdullah.
Yes, thanks for calling.
Thank you for accepting my call. Regarding what you were speaking to earlier about our inability to love each other as a community,
yes.
Here it is. There's a recent ebook I was listening to that was talking about the caste. And it comes out of a book, The Origin of Our Discontent,
mm-hmm.
by Isabel Wilkerson. where it talks about historically from this time of Noah and Ham and give that historical context that we people of color need to be subjugated. And from the experience of slavery, know that when slaves were separated, being mother from child or father from wife, that we were not supposed to show any emotion when that occurred. So some of these underlying sentiments may linger from slavery herein when we have that time of connecting. There's always just those things lingering behind us and tell us we should not tie our bonds. But and back to what Brother Christian was mentioning just now, to know of the British and their connection in the slave larger scheme of things, that there was a gold suit taken out of Ghana that had to be returned. So as one country in the British Commonwealth, they had the power then, even as an island, the British Isles, was able to pull all these resources from around the world. So, you know, from the triangular slave trade, they were one of the primary benefactors. So a lot light needs to be shared there as we contemplate reparations and the way going forward. I just wanted to add
And I'm glad you add that in there. Thank you so much, Dr. Joella. I really appreciate that. Folks, when we talk about how racism impacts every aspect of our lives, I want to put down one other thing, the ways in which Black men are battling with unfounded characteristics of being lazy, being shiftless, and being criminals to make them someone that you would not desire to have as a mate. Black women battle with unfounded characteristics of being angry, being gold diggers, that Black women are harder to get along. They're not going to tell you yes for anything. These are unfounded characteristics that are designed to push us away from each other and not to one another. We have Donna on the phone from Baltimore. Donna, how are you?
Hi, Dr. K. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Can you turn the radio down, Donna, please?
Yes, I did.
Thank you.
On your issue, on the discussion of Diane Stewart's about skin color, skin color is a global issue. And because when it was brought to my attention, because it really wasn't in my family, I guess it was, but it wasn't discussed. It came to light when, you know, I had friends of all hues, you know, the light skin, all the way down to dark. And it wasn't an issue until they brought it to my attention. Mm-hmm. I even had friends from China, and they brought it to my attention how widespread it is in China. So the skin color issue is deep in all cultures, whether it's in South America, Mexicans versus whatever. And, you know, it's an issue that I think, and including the white community, where, you know, if you don't have enough, I had a white coworker say that the reason why she had to wear stockings, her father made her wear stockings because her skin was too white.
Mm.
So this issue of skin color is just not, it's just in the Black community. It's in all the cultures, all racial groups. You know, having more melanin and not having melanin, whatever.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes I wonder, and, you know, you have men, you know, you have men, too, who perpetrated as well. For example, you have Black men who call light-skinned women red bone, which that gets the heart of me. Red bone. And light-skinned women don't like that. Very dark-skinned women don't like to be called Black and whatever. So these things, this stuff exists. My final point is that this misnomer that I had a family member who moved down south, and they really liked this woman. They didn't look at her because she was light-skinned. They just liked her. And her family said, he's not light-skinned enough, so you cannot date my daughter.
My word.
You know, so it's a Southern thing, and the further south, like my girlfriend, who was light-skinned, who passed away, when she moved from New York down here, she didn't realize how rampant skin color was until she came down here,
right.
And the Black men were running after her and ditching her dark-skinned friend because she was light-skinned, and she was very upset about that. So we really have to have more dialogue about this, the issue of skin color, not just in the black community, but in all cultures, because it's a problem, period.
Right, it is. But this particular study, because they were specifically looking at what was happening within the black community, that's why they just only amplify. We know that skin color, when it comes to gradations of skin, I mean, we know it's a problem in India. We know it's part of the caste system. It's part of, you know, Australia's dealing with the Aboriginal. We know it's not just an American thing. But in talking about the ways in which for us, skin color, is uniquely tied to the experience that black folks had on the plantation, because we know if your skin was, quote, lighter, you got to really talk about the history of rape and miscegenation
that took place.
Of why were you so light? Why did you have more European features?
Right,
because your mama was raped by the plantation owner.
Right, absolutely. And another thing is, I see how painful when I saw a woman in my office who she was the secretary, and her family there, she had siblings that were light skinned and she had siblings who were dark. Well, the parents treated the light skinned siblings better.
I've seen that. I've heard that.
And she was devastated. So when she had children, she told her sons, "You have to date light skinned women." And I was appalled. Really?
Oh, I've heard that.
Why would you perpetrate that same disease to your children?
Oh, I've heard people say that their parents have told them, you'll marry somebody who's light-skinned so your kid can have good hair.
Right.
I've heard those kind of statements.
Right.
Now, those
were
not the kind of statements in my family. Well, you know, in my immediate family, mom, dad, siblings.
Me too,
You know what I'm saying? Because I'm sure within my larger family coming from the South, those questions around good hair versus bad
good
hair, let's be very clear. We're only, Donna, at a point now that we can embrace all hair textures, because even when sisters wore their afro during the 60s, the Angela Davises on and such with the Black Panthers and you know, rejecting the kind of European style and symbols. Well, here we are today, and it's not as if everybody has natural hair. I mean, it's still, it's actually gone to the next level. Again, people are free to do what they want their hair, but we're not just perms, but we have more weaves. Like, we have really, this whole notion of having long hair, straight hair, is something that has continued. It has not stopped in our community.
Well, my final point is Dr. Ranoka Rashidi, he goes around looking for the Afro-Asians in Asia. And he showed pictures and sculptures of what African Asians looked like back in 1400s. And we had braids and hair color. The stuff you see now, we had that back in that time. So we were the ones who, our people, our ancestors created the weaves and the braids
all that
back then. So he was really good at showing how we looked even hundreds of years ago, and when it comes to weaves and hair and texture and the color and whatever like that. So it was interesting. Are you familiar with Dr. Ranoka Rashidi?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, I am.
Okay.
So,
thank you for your topic. And
thank
what's
you
the
so
name
much.
Of the book for Diane Stewart? Is it a book or is it a piece?
No, it's a book. Let me go back to the topic here. Thank you so much. Diane Stewart, her new book is called Black Women, Black Love, America's War on African-American Marriage. Folks, I have a clip here on colorism. I want to play that, and then I want to talk about Karen. I find this colorism thing, good hair, bad hair, light skin, dark skin, it is an ongoing issue that I like to believe that this next generation, because America's becoming blacker and browner and Asian than ever, I don't think they're going to have the same kind of issues around the unique link between race and between where you are valued within your culture. Let's take a listen to this clip.
When you think about studies that show that women of lighter skin tones get complimented more in general in a range of things than women of or young girls of darker skin tones. So if you're talking about even just in the school setting, you have two young girls who both do a great job. They both get A's on something, let's say. And the young woman who is of a lighter skin tone gets complimented and commended more. That's where your self-esteem comes from. That's what you start to believe. And how often are you reinforcing things and that you may not even realize you're reinforcing?
I remember in ninth grade, I thought, like, what if it just wasn't here? It'd just be easier. But, like, the only thing that got me through that was like my mom telling me and my friends, especially Kamaya, just like being there. And having someone to talk to, it just made me think like I can't leave them, because it keeps me like coming to school every day and like just like that smile on my face sometimes.
It's painful.
It is. Because this should have happened to anyone. We shouldn't have to hate ourselves because of the color of our skin. And the fact that I had to talk one of my best friends out of not wanting to be like that because of the color of her skin, about the fact that we're just so bad. It's not right.
That was a clip from Dark Girls. And folks, when you start talking about this issue around colorism, around love, around the intersections between love and race, you start to see how all of it is connected. That if we want to trace this back to the root of what happened, to get us to a place, as Malcolm X said, who taught you to hate yourself? I expand on that. Who told you you weren't beautiful? Who told you you weren't desirable? Who told you that you were not important? Who told you that you were less than? Who told you that you shouldn't dream out loud? Who told you there was no space for you on the bus? Who told you that the only place you belonged was in the prison? Who told you that? Who taught you that you can't have a successful relationship? There's no such thing as black love, even though Nikki Giovanni once wrote that black love is black wealth. 410-319-8888. While you simmer on that, let me end on a little bit of a lighter note. And I'll see if Justina can find us any clip of Karen. So The Root has a piece that came out by Michael Harriet, one of my favorite writers on The Root. And he said, look, Karen is dead. That term, Karen, that there's now a Wikipedia page for the definition of a Karen. When it finds its way into the lexicon in that way, it's gone. So lit, bae, kayawita, all those terms can't be used anymore, because when they go into the lexicon of the more general society, it doesn't belong to us. Wikipedia describes a Karen as a pejorative term for a woman seeming to be entitled or demanding beyond the scope of what is normal. Michael Harris said, you know what, Wikipedia's definition is not true. It's apparent that somebody who is white wrote that definition, because what it is, when you start talking about Karens, not all Karens are meddlesome. Not all annoying white women are Karens. It doesn't work like this. Not the two things are completely linked together. What it is this is a long history of meddlesome white women. That's when we say we use the word Karen. The Karen notion is not something that is new. It is something that we're figuring out. That they're saying Karen has a couple of different siblings. I find this to be so funny. That it starts with Ashley. Ashley is a white woman who has not yet evolved into Karenhood. It's a young Karen. You also have Becky. Becky is a white woman capable of metamorphosing into one of those categories. She can be an Ashley sometimes, or she can be a Karen. Ashley's are generic. Store brand. This is what this article is talking about. He goes into the six different types of Karen, which I find, I was chuckling when I was reading this. And so the six different types of Karens, here we go. The first one is the one I mentioned previously, an Ashley. Ashleys are generic. Ashleys have not evolved into being a Karen, but they're on their way. Marjorie Taylor Greene, he believes, is an Ashley. Ivanka Trump is an Ashley. That when you hit the age of Ashley, it's someone who can still, you can metamorphosize into becoming a Karen. Karen is the root. Karen is the place. That's when you start talking about calling the cops on black people. that's when you talk about that notion of Karen. He also argues that you have a Carol. A Carol is a law-abiding citizen who polices black bodies in her spare time. That this notion of watching what black people do and calling the cops on black people, a passive, aggressive behavior with black people, and the ways in which we are unable to move forward. Think about Amy Cooper. Think about Meghan McCain. They even said here, Bette Midler. What does it mean to police the behavior of black women? Because that does happen. It's looking at what black folks are doing and deciding that it is not legal. And we're noticing that this is happening across the board. A recent story came up where it was a father and his son, black folks, going with a black rental agent, going to a house, looking at this house to possibly buy it. Someone, they're saying it was a Karen, a Becky, a Maggie, a Carol, because Maggie's another form of a Karen. And Maggie is the one who is older than Karen's, and somebody who is, you know, someone who really actually used the N-word before, that last part of that baby boomer generation. Miss Ann is up there. People are raising Karens. But when we look at all of this, and we see it come to a head. This black man with his son was actually going to look at a house. It was just a rental. He ended up being handcuffed. His son was handcuffed. So this happened, and just to pull this story out, it happened in Michigan. A black realtor was showing a house to a black man and his 15-year-old son in a Michigan suburb. When they looked outside, police officers had surrounded the property with their guns drawn. Can you imagine what the cops had heard to make them show up with their guns drawn? The father said, I knew once they surrounded the home that they were preparing for a standoff. I want you just to come with me for a second and just imagine this. You're inside of a home. You're with the rental agent. You're with your 15-year-old son. You're walking through the house to see if you want to buy it. You're thinking about the neighborhood, asking about schools, maybe thinking about where you want to put your furniture, and you're thinking, can we afford it? This is great. You look outside the window. Cops have shown up. They've surrounded the house, and they have their guns out. What were the cops told to get them to show up like that? The father said when he talked to CNN's Don Lemon, we might be able to get the clip, he said, my instincts told me we need to get out of here. We need to get to where they can see that we are not a threat. Part of the issue of being black in America is having to always prove that you are not a threat. Zora Simone, the list I'm talking about, is on The Root. It was written by Michael Harriet, The Six Types of Karen. What ended up happening is that a neighbor had called authorities, telling the cops that a suspect arrested at the property a week ago had returned to the scene. So what that neighbor did by getting and by inserting themselves into the issue could have ended up with a man, a black man, his 15-year-old son, and a black realtor being shot and killed by the police because the police showed up, surrounded the house with their guns drawn. When you talk about real fright in this society, that is one of them. That just sounds frightening and scary. They were handcuffed. They were eventually released, but not without incident. The Wyoming police ordered them out of the house with their hands up, handcuffed them, put Thomas and his 15-year-old son in the back seat of separate police vehicles. The man says, look, I just wanted to get my son out of there. We were just looking at a house that we were thinking about buying. 410-319-8888. Richard's on the phone. Richard, how are you?
Are you Dr. K? Pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, pleasure to have you call in.
Well, I called in because what you're talking about occurred in Michigan. And I just want to relate to an incident that occurred in Michigan in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
11 people, black people, were tried for murder in a case. And what it involved is this doctor and his family moved into a white neighborhood. And the residents of the neighborhood formed a quote-unquote neighborhood improvement committee.
Mm.
And they marched around his house for 3 days straight. Well, of course, you know, they couldn't get out. Nobody could get in. And someone in the house shot into the crowd and killed a man by the name of Mr. Mall. And subsequent to that situation, all 11 residents of the home, it was the doctor, his brother, his mother, his son, and a bunch of other members of his family, and they were all tried for murder. Clarence Darrow, who is a very well-respected lawyer who passed away some years ago, and who gave a 7.5-hour argument, a closing arguments in that particular case, you might find of interest to look into that.
Thank you so much. I definitely will look into that and take a look at this case. We got to take a look at this. I know there's a great piece out called The Sweet Trials, Clarence Darrow and Race, and there's a piece about Clarence Darrow in the American experience. So we're going to take, if the case that the caller is talking about is the People versus Ossian Sweet et al., and this speech was Clarence Darrow's ending closing argument in the first Sweet trial, a trial that ended in a hung jury as to all 11 defendants. This is fascinating. I'll take another look at this weekend. Let me now go, before we end off for the week, let me just take a quick check-in with Anthony McCarthy and Two-Way Talk. I'd like to get an idea of what's happening on the show tonight. Anthony, how are you?
I'm doing well, Dr. K.
I really appreciate having you on. What do you and Kara Williams, your co-host, have set for tonight?
We have usually every Friday what we call the Reporters Roundtable.
Mm-hmm.
And so tonight we have three reporters joining us. We're going to talk about Governor Cuomo, the bipartisan infrastructure bill that was passed by the Senate, waiting on the House to pull something together, the UN climate report, and a bunch of other issues around COVID and other things. The reporters are Mark Steiner, Pam Jones, and Hassan Giordano.
Oh, some of my favorite people.
Oh, nice.
Some of my favorite people. I know Hassan, he's getting ready to do some things with Sheila Dixon.
He sure is.
Amir Dixon. And then Mark Steiner, of course, used to be on WEAA with the Mark Steiner Show. And Pam Jones,
who's older.
And she's also on the radio. So
she's on WBL, yeah.
I will be listening.
All right, sis.
I will be listening. Thank you so much for everything, Anthony. It's been an honor and a privilege to serve you in this way this week, folks. Meet me back here on Monday at 2 p.m. And let's have another conversation that matters.